The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled How to Become Well-Respected, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmas Eli Rivka Bas Meir Leib Olecha HaSholom, Mrs. Elaine Swimmer, of blessed memory.
Honor, respect, glory. These are some of the sweetest words in the English language. Throughout the ages, millions, perhaps billions of men have risked their lives to achieve this ephemeral goal. The Medal of Honor is the name of the highest tribute that this nation bestows. And so sensitive are we to dishonor or humiliation that battles are often waged and atrocities committed in an attempt to avenge some perceived personal or national affront. There are yet other beautiful words in our language. Recognition, appreciation. These are the words you're likely to encounter in any motivational seminar. They're one of the greatest tools that management uses to motivate and compensate their employees. And so hungry are we for attention and respect that we often fail to realize how easily we can be manipulated and used when honors and accolades are dangled in front of us. And how easily we can be blinded to the truth in the midst of basking in the pleasures of glory. This reminds me of the story of two old friends who had not seen each other for years. By chance, one of them was passing through the hometown of the other. He didn't know his friend's address, but he did know that his friend was the president of the local shul or synagogue. Stopping one of the townspeople on the street, he asked him, "Do you know the address of my friend? I understand he's the president of the shul." "Him?" the other man angrily replied, after a barrage of curses and epithets, and after admonishing him to choose his friends more carefully. He told the friend that the president lives on the other side of town on a certain street, but he didn't know the exact address. After finally finding the street, he knocked on the first door and asked, "Do you know in which house the president of the shul lives?" "He's an old friend of mine. I wanted to surprise him." "Him?" the enraged neighbor shouted. "If you're a friend of his, you don't belong in my house. I unfortunately have the misfortune of living next door to him. If I had my way, I would have thrown him out of town a long time ago." Hastily making his way out of the house before the neighbor became violent, he ran to the next house and knocked on his friend's door. What a surprise. After hugging and kissing, enjoying each other's company, and retelling stories and recalling events of long ago, the visitor mustered up the courage to ask his friend, "Oh, by the way, I wanted to ask you a question. I know it's a difficult job to be president, so why do you do it?" The president looked stunned. "Why do I do it? For the cover! For the honor and prestige, of course." Why do we yearn for honor and respect? What is true honor? And how to achieve it are only some of the topics we will cover tonight. I've divided this lecture into 7 parts. The first letter of the title of each part, spelling out the acronym Dignity. I hope you all have a handout. The D of dignity is dignity. We first begin, this is on paragraph A, on the first one, page 2, with a quote from the Talmud. This is taken from Sanhedrin, Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, 37a. Kol echod ve'echod chayev lomar. Every single person is required to say, Bishvili nivra ha'olam. Because of me was the world created. If I would be the only person on earth, it still would be worth it all. Because I am worth that much. And it's a requirement, just as a requirement to be kind and a requirement to do good, there's a requirement to look at yourself as if you would be the only person on earth. It would be worth it all. What makes a person so important? We go to paragraph B. And this is taken from Avos, from Ethics of the Fathers. Every human being, you know, is important. Beloved is man, for he was created in God's image. The idea of God's image is that we have intelligence, we have sensitivity, we have free will. We are spiritual in the sense that our consciousness survives bodily death. And not only are we important, but God exhibited his love by telling us how important we are. And it continues on as indicative of a greater love that it was made known that he was created in God's image. Very often we are blessed with tremendous gifts. But since we don't know about them, we never utilize them. We're very fortunate not only were we created in God's image, but we were so informed. And beloved are the people Israel because of their special relationship with God. We are the people of the covenant. We are called the children of God. As it says, you are my children. It says, Bonim Atem, says Lashem Elokecha, to Hashem, your God. Every human being is important. A person who has a connection to Torah is important. We should never look at ourselves as unimportant. This feeling that we have of being important, and we yearn for recognition of that importance, is uniquely human. As Dale Carnegie, the author of the bestseller How to Win Friends and Influence People, put it, quote, "The desire for a feeling of importance is one of the chief distinguishing differences between mankind and the animals." In other words, our subconscious mind, our soul, realizes this. And never ceases to keep on communicating this message to us that we are truly worthy. The problem is that often on the conscious level, we view ourselves quite differently. This tension between our subconscious, this feeling inside that I truly have great worth, and our conscious, the sense that we get from the stimuli, how people treat us, how our place is, how we're recognized, creates this dissonance and this desperate need. You know, sometimes we begin to feel like Rodney Dangerfield. We just can't get no respect. But when we do get honored, it's not only music to our ears, but it also reinforces the subconscious view of ourselves and the dignity that we're so entitled. And let's tell you a beautiful story. This story is printed in the Machzor, in the prayer book for Rosh Hashanah. It's a special prayer book. It has Yiddish translation with Yiddish commentary. And in this prayer book, in this Machzor, it tells over a beautiful story. There was once a king's daughter, the only daughter to the king. Beautiful girl, very talented. And the king looked far and wide to find a chosen, to find a fitting groom for his daughter. And finally he found someone with all the qualities that he felt that his daughter needed in a husband. And it was a very special wedding. And not only was the food in the hall something unusual, but he hired the most distinguished musicians of the realm and had them compose an entire score only for this wedding. Every part of that wedding was planned, and every part had a special piece composed for it. It was the most unforgettable wedding that ever occurred in that country. And in the week following the wedding, they had tremendous festivities. And in a lull between the activities, the king and his new son-in-law and the princess decided to take a little boat trip. The country was on a major sea, and they took two large boats. On one boat was the king and his son-in-law. The other boat was the kala, was the bride, the princess, together with the orchestra. So the orchestra was playing those beautiful tunes while the princess was sitting, and close by was the king and the prince. And as they were going, as the two boats were going in tandem near the seashore, unbeknownst to them, a storm was brewing. And suddenly the sky turned dark, and it started thundering and lightning, tremendous winds. And the boats grew apart and became so dark that the boats couldn't see each other. And the boat of the princess was driven far away to shore, from shore. In fact, to the opposite shore, to a different country, where it crashed. And the people of the other country came, saved what they could. The princess survived, and most of the members of the orchestra survived. Unfortunately, this country was at war with her father's country. And when they realized the identity of the princess, they immediately shackled her and put her into prison. The musicians, since they were non-combatants, they let them go and ply their trade in this new country. So here was this princess in a dungeon in darkness and filth. And after some time, the king of this other country had compassion for her and decided he had nothing to gain by keeping her. And he made her a slave, part of the kitchen staff of his palace. So she started working, scrubbing, cleaning, cooking with all the other of the kitchen staff. And it was something very foreign to her. Her hands were the hands of a princess. They weren't calloused. They were meticulously manicured. And here she had to work she never worked in her life. And she had to be socialized with these people. And they spoke a language, actually both countries spoke the same language, but it was the language of the underclass. It was unrefined. It was something which was grating to her ears. And it took a very, very long time till she got used to being part of that scene. For nights she would stay up and just cry. But we often have a mechanism to deal with that kind of stress. As time went by and the years went on by, she forgot her royal beginnings. And she began to speak like them and to look like them. And in fact, she, after many years had passed, she had forgotten that she was really born of royalty. One day, the king decided to honor his kitchen staff. He wanted to show them some sign of appreciation. So he decided to host a dinner in their honor. And here, he brought the finest musicians of the land, which happened to be those musicians, that landed on those shores so many years before with the princess. He honored them with a fabulous meal. He had the musicians play. And of course, they played the best songs that they had ever composed, the wedding songs of that princess. And as they began to play and she began to hear the music, the familiar chords, familiar melodies, she became very distraught. Uncontrollably, she began to cry, and she finally fainted. When they revived her, they asked her, "What happened?" She says, no, it's not your fault. But after all those years, I had totally forgotten," said, "that I'm truly royalty. I don't belong here. But when I heard that music, it brought back those memories, and I realized I'm truly a stranger in this foreign palace." The one who authored this story, prayer book, continues on. He says, "The Jews, as a people, also once had a wedding. That wedding is when the Torah was given on Mount Sinai. And the music that was played was the sound of the shofar. As the Torah says, as it was given in this unbelievable sight of the fire and the smoke, the music was the sound of the shofar. Every Rosh Hashanah, we come together and we hear that sound. There's something that touches our subconscious mind. There's something when we hear that sound that tells us we're truly royalty. We don't belong where we are. We're busy at work. We're busy with our careers and our families. And we often forget that really much more is expected of us. We're truly great nobility, but we've forgotten it. It's that sound of the shofar that brings it out." That's the story. It's a beautiful little mushel. It's a little beautiful little analogy of the role of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. But in a certain sense, if we could borrow that analogy, every time that we get honored, every time that people appreciate us for what we truly are, there's also, it's like the sound of the shofar. There's some resonance. We feel, you know, that's right. I truly am worthy. So the D of dignity, this is dignity. The I is indignity. Again, if you, on page 2, under I, paragraph A, you can read it through yourself. But we have in the bold print, this is taken from the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Nun Ches Amud Beis in 58b. "He who publicly shames his neighbor is as though he shed blood." Just as we prize dignity, one of the worst crimes is humiliation. Because in a sense, if you humiliate another person and you treat him as he's not worthy of respect, you're robbing him of his soul, of his spirituality. Because as we said, what makes us all dignified? What makes us worthy of respect? Because we're spiritual beings. We can think. We can feel. But by humiliating a person, you're telling him, well, that's not worth anything. He says, you're a nobody. That's tantamount to murder. And that's why the Talmud is so sensitive to humiliation and indignity. We crave respect, not just denying it, but humiliating a person. Telling him, in a sense, you're worthless, is a crime of the highest magnitude. So D is dignity, I is indignity, and takes us now to G. We deserve dignity. We don't want to be shamed. Here's page 4 here. How can we get respect? And again, this is for you to take home with you, and you could read this. And because of the time considerations, we can just quote some of this. How do you become honored is by honoring others. And here we have on page 4, Ezehu Mechubot, who is honored? He who honors others. The secret of receiving, you want to get respected. The secret of receiving is giving. Again, Dale Carnegie, in his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, this is, I quote, give honest, sincere appreciation. Be hearty in your approbation and lavish in your praise. And people will cherish your words and treasure them and repeat them over a lifetime. Repeat them years after you've forgotten them. The greatest gift you can give someone is dignity, is respect. But by giving that respect, ultimately you're giving yourself respect. In a certain sense, we are all jewels. But only a maven, only an expert, can tell the difference between a diamond and glass. And I have a story to tell about that a little later in the lecture. If you look at a person and say, you know what, you're truly a diamond. The whole world thinks you're glass. But I'm an expert. I know what diamonds are. You're a diamond. The person who receives that, who hears that, not only is appreciative, but realizes a person who's a maven on diamonds is a diamond himself. You want to get respected, start giving it. And the opposite is also true, which takes us to N, here, down the page. You know, we went with D is dignity, I is indignity, G is giving, N is negation. The Talmud tells over a story of how Alexander the Great, after he conquered Gaza, came to Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, he had a long talk with the scholars, with the sages, with the members of the Sanhedrin. And they spoke about various philosophical issues. One of them was the idea of how to live life, how to live a full life. And here it is, this is on N here. Ma yavod inish v'yichya, what shall a man do to live? And they replied, says, yamas atzmo, let him mortify himself. In essence, he should kill himself. And the commentaries explain, you want to enjoy life? Says, be humble. That's mortify yourself. Put yourself down. Give respect to others. Because when you begin to respect others, people appreciate that. You're not a threat to them. In fact, you're their greatest supplier of that which they most desperately need. Dignity. And if you, the irony is, when you lower yourself and honor others, you become very honored. And life is very sweet. But on the other hand, and the question was, Ma yavod inish v'yomos, what shall a person do to kill himself? What should a person do if he wants to live a miserable life that leads to an early death? And they replied, let him keep himself alive. Yechayes atzmo. He should have a high profile. He should lord over others. He should try to control other people. Because there's nothing that a person dislikes is someone starts lording over them, starts competing with them, starts treating them as if they were nothing. And people react. And the reaction is they treat you in turn with scorn. So a person not only does not enjoy life, but the sum total of all the aggravation that he has leads to an early death. Which reminds me of a beautiful story. It's a fable. The lion, king of beasts, decided to make known who truly is boss. And one day, the lion went over to the leopard, started crowding him. Says, who's the king of the jungle? The leopard, cowed, replied, you are, sire. A little while later, again to prove his position, the lion went over to the bear, started crowding him, growling in his face, who's the king of the jungle? And again, to which the bear has replied, you are, sire. He went over to the elephant, started crowding the elephant, looks up at him and says, who's the king of the jungle? With that, the elephant took his trunk, wrapped the lion, threw him 100 yards into a large rock. The lion, bruised, bloodied, dazed, finally gets up to his feet, lifts up his paw, looks straight at the elephant, says, just because you don't know the answer doesn't mean you got to be so angry. Lording doesn't always work. The I is elusive. Very often, we try perhaps not to lord over people, not to put people down, but we try to get this honor or that honor. You know, something like the president, we started the story with the president of the shul, the president of the congregation. And here the Talmud speaks about how elusive the idea of honor is when you try directly to get it. Here this is on I, here on page 4. And this is taken from the Talmud, Sigmar, in Erev and Yud Gimel and Beis in 13b. He who humbles himself, the Holy One, blessed be He, raises up. And he who exalts himself, like Biatzmo, the Holy One, blessed be He, humbles. From him who seeks greatness, greatness flees. But he who flees from greatness, greatness follows. It's quite ironic. If you want honor and you run after it, you can't get it. And those who run away, honor seems very often. Those are just worthy of honor. But they run away from it. It seems to chase them. There's a very cute little vowel, there's a very cute little saying regarding this passage of the Talmud. And the question was asked, well, what difference does it make? If you run after it, it runs away. You run away, it runs after you. But the twain don't meet. And the answer is, yes, it's true. When you run away from it, it just runs after us. But when you get older, you can't run so fast. Somehow, eventually, that catches up to you. So here in N and I, we discuss the idea of if you run for it, if you try to control others, if you try to put yourself in the limelight, it doesn't always work. We've spoken about the idea of becoming worthy of honor by giving. We said if you give honor, you get honor. There's another method, and that gives us to T, which is Torah. This is on the bottom of page 4. This T. This is paragraph A. The Talmud says you could look at the passage yourself. This is taken from a Gemara in Shabbos in 63. What is meant by the verse? It says one is studies Torah. It says there's orach yomim bimino. There's length of days in her right hand. Bismoyloi shevachovad, in her left hand are riches and honor. One who studies Torah is honored. It's a blessing. Even those who don't necessarily study it for the right reasons and don't necessarily put all their effort into it. If you have Torah, there's an automatic, you're a different person. The honor automatically comes. People recognize there's something different with you. You have wisdom. Of course, and here we turn to page 5, wisdom, Torah, should not be studied as a vehicle to get honor. There was one said there's a very cute little folk story about this fellow who walked into to shul, and he picked up, you know, if you've seen the whole set of the Talmud, they're very, in a full set, sort of Vilna Shas, they're very large and heavy. And he started taking volume after volume from the bookshelf. The person looked at him and said, this is a true scholar. He's taking volume after volume. He said, what is he doing with all of those books? And what he saw is he took those volumes, he set it up as a stepping stone. As he put like 5 on the first level, put 4 on the next one, 3 on the next one, 2 on the next one, 1 on the next, and he used it as a stepping stone because he had hidden, before Shabbos, he had left some money on top of the bookcase. And he just came to pick it off. The Talmud, the Torah, is not a means. It's an end. And really, and this, if you look at the notes here, this is taken from the Gemara Nedarim and Salaf Beis Amud Aleph in 62a, but it's not a spade to dig with. But nonetheless, if you change, if you're a person that spirituality means much, you've gained not just trivia, but true wisdom. When you become a changed individual, people see it. In other words, if you want honor, you have to become worthy of that honor. Of course, we said every person has this innate spirituality. But you have to come, you have to touch it. You have to feel it. It's like a garden. If you just plant a seed, it may or may not grow. But if you put fertilizer, and you irrigate it, and you pull out the weeds, you're much more likely to see that that seed would grow up into a full plant. We have this innate spirituality, but it has to be cultivated. The study of Torah with all its immense wisdom is a means of cultivating that seed. Perhaps, and this is just an aside, one of the great failings of this generation is that despite the, in a certain sense, the many gains, so many yeshivas were here tonight studying, basically studying Torah. But we have the vast majority of Jewry that's so ignorant of Torah. You know, last week, I had the privilege of being in Madison Square Garden, where there's a celebration that there was of the Talmud. There's a system where if one learns one folio, there's one full page, front and back, a day, for 7.5 years, one will have completed a Talmud. And there are people that get up early in the morning or come to classes late at night and spend time just studying one folio at a time, day after day. After 7.5 years, they came together to celebrate. Madison Square Garden was full. There was 22,000 people sitting there. In the theater, which is in the Feld Forum, which is adjacent to Madison Square Garden, was also full. I believe there were some 4,000 people. In NASA Coliseum in Long Island, they had a parallel celebration, and there was a satellite hookup between the two places. There was another 18,000, and then across the country, through satellite hookup, there were thousands of thousands, just all celebrating the fact that the Torah was studied. It was such a beautiful. Some 70,000 people in all were involved in the celebration. And it's just wonderful. But if you think, on the other hand, there's some 5.5 million Jews in America. How many of them have any connection to this Torah? So as an aside, is that we view that this idea of studying Torah is something which brings out this innate spirituality. But we shouldn't be selfish with it. We should make sure so not only that we take advantage of it, but our families and our friends, our neighbors also take advantage of it. There's another means of bringing out this innate feeling of dignity. Here again on page 5, here on paragraph D and E, it's important to dress the part. If you really feel yourself to be dignified, you look at yourself as a truly spiritual being, a person that whose worth can't be measured. If you dress the part, it reinforces not only image to others, but to yourself as well. We often forget, it's like the story of the princess in the kitchen. We often forget what we truly are. And he says that the clothes makes the man. He says, if you dress like somebody who's of truly worth, it reinforces that message to ourselves. And this is the statement here in paragraph E in the bottom page 5 in the Gemara in Shabbos in 113a. Is Rabbi Yochanan kor lemane mechabdusai. Rabbi Yochanan called his garments my source of dignity. So we've discussed up enough the idea of becoming honored through giving honor, through cultivating that innate spirituality that we all have through the study of Torah, and through outwardly, this is reinforcing that message to ourselves and to others, we're true people that are dignified. The why, this is the last page, page 6, is you. Here we quote from the Talmud Yerushalmi in Sanhedrin, in chapter 1, Halacha, this is in the second section. Rabbi Kiva told a student of his, this is Rabbi Shimon, who felt that he was not given the honors that were his due. He says, even if no one honors you, and no one tells you, you should know for yourself. He says, at least I recognize it, and God recognizes it. You truly are worthy. Very often in life, we don't get the honors we deserve. People don't look at us the way we really should be looked at. There are people that are plain people, at least on the outside. People whose livelihood affords them only the basic necessities. Whose position in the community is not very often held in the highest of esteem. But these people are giants. And a person has to learn to appreciate himself. And if you begin to appreciate yourself and spend the time to appreciate yourself, people will see it as well. For a time, one of America's best-selling authors was Ayn Rand. The author of Fountainhead and Atlas shrugged. She made the point in describing her heroes that if you truly respect yourself, others will as well. Her heroes had presence. Her heroes felt their own dignity. I'm not referring to arrogance. I'm not referring to threatening others. Remember the story of the lion and the elephant. Just normally having a positive self-image radiates that image to others. They respond to you, in other words, accordingly. You come in and have the bearing of someone, not someone who's arrogant, not someone who's putting on airs, but someone who's appreciated of his own worth. And you feel confident about yourself. People look at you differently. They see there's a somebody here. But you have to begin to appreciate your worth. Your worth is not how much money you make or what position you have in your company. Your worth can't be taken away from you. Your worth is that you're a neshama, that you're our soul. There's no worth, there's no money tag that can be put to that. You can feel, you can think, you have sensitivity. And after all, as we said, we're eternal, we're souls. So let me just sum up what we've covered so far. We began with this acronym of dignity. And the D of dignity is every person is worthy of dignity. And even if he'd be the only person on earth, he'd be worth it all. I is indignity, the tremendous crime of humiliating another person. G is you get covered, you get honor by giving. G is giving. N is negation. You get honor by humbling yourself. That's not humiliating yourself, but trying to build up others. You get an honored place, and you have a pleasant life. Let's remember the story of the lion and the elephant. I is elusive. If you try to get the honors, you try to put yourself up front, people don't enjoy it. And it's very elusive. You try, you don't get it. On the other hand, if you're truly worthy of honor, but you run away, you honor other people, eventually it'll catch up to you. T is Torah. By studying Torah, you cultivate that innate spirituality that you have. And you're truly worthy of honor. And we put this as a side, the importance of dressing the part. Reinforce it to yourself. Tell yourself. When you dress up in the morning, look at yourself and say, I'm a person of true worth. And why is you? You have to begin to look at yourself. Train yourself to look at myself. I am worthy. Like the Mishnah we quoted in the beginning of the class, a person is required to say every day, Bishvili Nivra Olam, because of me, the world was created. It's worth it all. And if you have that positive image of yourself, it's automatically projected to others. You have that healthy respect of yourself. People, you're somebody. They respect you as well. I'd like to end with another acronym about how to cultivate that innate spirituality that you have. And the acronym here is PRAY. P-R-A-Y. And the P is prayer. Very often we think of prayer as going into a large building and attending a performance, a very pleasant performance, an uplifting performance. But we're not participants. We're viewers. But prayer ideally should be done in our heart, in the confines of our homes, at the table where we eat, when we wake up in the morning. Unfortunately, for many of us, prayer is done either in a foreign language or in a very archaic language. I know there's one prayer book that's written in contemporary English with very enlightening, short but enlightening commentary. That's a great place to start. It's called the Art Scroll Siddur. It's contemporary English. You don't have to take it all in once. Just take a page at a time. And you feel ill at ease saying it, they'll just think it. But there's so much there. We're just bombarded with stimuli that keeps on telling us that the only way of making it in life is by portraying ourselves as this wealthy, successful, whatever. And if we don't have it, we're worthless. When we pray in the morning, we begin to appreciate how much we truly do have, and how much we're really worth, and we're so privileged to have that sense of spirituality, that contact with the divine. It's a tremendous boost for one's own sense of dignity. So the P is prayer. R is read. Reading could be learning Torah. Reading could be a tremendous amount of wisdom literature. Expand your mind. There's one thing that I've spoken of continually in lectures past, about all the works that are recently put out by researchers about near-death experiences and reincarnation memories. All the evidence to show we truly are spiritual beings. If we reinforce that idea, that we truly are spiritual beings, we'll look at ourselves differently. I mean, how can we... there's no price to be put on our worth. Every accolade that we get is so minor compared to what we truly are worth. But we have to take the time. We should pamper ourselves and read. So the P is prayer, R is read. A is act. Very often we don't feel we're well respected. Other people don't respect us. But if we start acting the part, the message starts seeping in. Even if you've never done this before, start complimenting other people. Start giving respect to other people. If you've never done this before and you've always walked with stooped shoulders and some sort of like a schlepper, like you go one foot at a time, lift yourself up. Just walk like a mensch. Just, if you begin to act like someone with dignity, says, you feel you're really true. It enforces this message. I'm a person of true worth. It's not arrogance. It's not because I'm smarter than anybody else or I'm more talented than anybody else. I don't have to be better than anyone else because I'm worth so much just by myself. The A is act. The Y is you. You know, we're often so busy. We're running carpool. We're going to our jobs. We have to take care of this meeting and that thing and the other thing. We just never spend time with ourselves. And when we do take the time, we just try to bombard ourselves with stimuli. We go out. We go out to eat. We see we're entertained this way or that way or the other way. You know, it's worthwhile just to shut everything off in your house and just sit down and meditate. Just think. You know, hold yourself. You know, here, that's really me. You know, it's... Spend some time with yourself. You know, when the Jews complained about their slavery and Moshe Rabbeinu came to Pharaoh and told him, let my people go, Pharaoh's reply is, you know, they have too much free time on their hands. They're dangerous, these people. Work them some more. A person with free time who spends his time wisely is a dangerous person because they begin to think, hey, how can I change my life? Start pampering yourself. Just take that. Just sit down. Forget everything. Just sit down. And just think, you know. Just hum to yourself, you know. Begin to learn to like yourself. You know, I'm sure it may not be that, you know, your fan club may not be very large, but, you know, at least you should, like, have a button, you know, I'm number one. You know? If you begin to like yourself, it shows. Because there's so much to like. I'd like to end off with a little story. It's a beautiful story. I want to take the message of that story and apply it to all that I've said tonight. But just again, remember, pray is P is pray. Make it a daily part of your life. Just open it up. Take a page. Look at it. Say it. It's beautiful. R is read. Spend the time to read, to study Torah, to study things which enhance your sense of your true spirituality. A is act. Begin to act the part. Start respecting and complimenting other people. You'll find it'll make a whole world of difference. Act the part of somebody who's truly worthy. I mean, not arrogant, but truly worthy. Stand up straight. Walk like a mensch. Why is you owe it to yourself. Spend the time to start just thinking. Meditating on yourself. Begin to spend time with yourself. You like somebody else, you like to spend time with them. Begin to spend a little time with yourself. The story that I want to tell you took place 150 years ago. I wasn't able to verify if the story is true or even has a kernel of truth, but it's a great story. In Russia, Jews were only allowed to settle in a certain confined areas, in the Ukraine, in Poland, White Russia. In Russia proper, a Jew needed a special permit. It's as if he would be immigrating. He would be immigrating into Russia. If you didn't have that permit, you weren't allowed to be there. It would be like that we have the problem today here with illegal immigrants. And it was very difficult for a Jew to get that certificate, that allowance of living inside Russia. One had to be a professional. One had to be very wealthy. It was very difficult to get that exemption. But people at least tried to sneak across the border. And without living beyond the sanction of law, they went into Russia itself and tried to eke out a living. One time, says the Tsar himself, was strolling in one of the parks in St. Petersburg. He happened to see a Jew sitting on a park bench. He went over to him and he asked him, says, "Do you have a permit?" He says, "No." "What do you do for a living?" He says, "I'm a maven." A maven, really, it's a Yiddish word. It really comes from the Hebrew. Lahavin is a person with discernment. Is an expert. "I'm a professional expert." I guess being a maven wasn't the list of the trades and professions that one is allowed to have in order to get this permit. And he threw the person. The Tsar told the soldiers who were going with him to seize that man and to throw him into prison. And with that, he was thrown into prison. Sometime later, some merchants from the Far East came to the Tsar and offered him this exquisite stone, only worthy of the Tsar, a stone that they wanted millions of rubles for. It was the most exquisite diamond that he had ever seen in his life, so well faceted. The fire of that diamond, the clarity of that diamond. But it was an awful lot of money. After all, the needs of a czar and running an army and a government are vast. He wasn't sure that that this actually was worth the millions of rubles that these merchants demanded. He says, who could he ask? From whom could he seek advice? He decided, "I'm going to ask the maven." He took the maven out of the dungeon. He asked him, "What do you think about this stone?" Put on his glasses like this. He looked at the stone, a hin and a hev, and then he's looking like this and like that. And he says, "It's glass. It's the most beautiful imitation I've ever seen, but it's glass. You hit that with a small hammer over here," and he pointed, "it will shatter into a million pieces. A diamond won't shatter like that." Should he believe him? Should he not believe him? decided to try it. He had one of his men take a hammer, hit it exactly where the maven told him to hit it. It shattered into a million pieces. The Tsar was very thankful. He gave the maven 100 ruble and sent them back into his cell in prison. Sometime later, another merchant came to the Tsar. This time, he brought the most exquisite horse that the Tsar had ever seen. And he said, this horse, the Yichesbrief, in other words, the genealogy, the pedigree of this horse, took books. You know what I mean? Started with, you know, secretariat and went out to citation. It went down the list of all the great horses of history. And this horse looked impressive. Who could he ask? Who would know about horses? They wanted a million rubles for this horse. The maven. Again, he schlepped the maven out of his prison cell, brought him out, and asked him, what do you think about this horse? The maven walked around the horse, you know, like kicked the tires, you know, moved here and there and gave it up to friends here and that. And he says, it's a beautiful horse, but once you start riding that horse is going to bolt, is going to throw the rider off that horse and going to instantly kill that rider. This horse is unrideable. He wasn't sure what he should do. He took one of his Cossacks. That is the same height and build. Told the Cossack to start riding that horse. And as it was getting to full gallop, it stopped, threw the Cossack off, instantly killed the Cossack. Here the maven saved the life of the emperor, the Tsar. The Tsar was very impressed. This time he gave him 200 ruble, sent him back to his prison cell. That night, the Tsar did not have an easy sleep. He didn't know what to do with this maven here. Viesna, was tut mir mit dem? What do we do with this maven? He never saw a person like that in his life. And he was rolling in bed, one back to the side, one back and forth. Anyways, he got out of bed. He called one of his guards and he says, bring me the maven. A few minutes later, the maven was abruptly awoken from his sleep, quickly dressed, came into the Tsar's private chambers. The Tsar looked at him and he says, you're disturbing me, you know. I have one question to ask you. What do you think of me? Now the maven turned white. It's one thing to talk about a piece of glass and a horse. It's another thing to be about the Tsar. The Tsar looked at him and said, don't worry. Whatever I promise you, whatever you say, I will not punish you. Tell me, what do you think of me? And the maven said, you're a brilliant person. You're from a tremendous stamina and vigor. But one thing, you're not a Romanov. You're not the true Tsar. You don't have royal blood. The Tsar turned ashen white. He didn't know what to do. So far, the maven had not been proven wrong. His elderly mother, who was dying, was in the palace. It was the middle of the night. He walked over to his mother's room, woke her up, took his sword and took it to her neck, and he says, Mama, you have to tell me, am I a Romanov? Do I have royal blood? Or am I a commoner? And she looked at her son, and he says, Son, I always wanted to hide the truth from you. You're not a Romanov. He was shocked. Here was the Tsar, the Emperor of Russia, and he was an imposter. Sullenly, he walked back to his own chambers. The maven was still standing with the guard. He says, how did you know? How did you know I wasn't a Romanov? And the maven told him, you know, I saved you 1,000,000 rubles. You weren't tricked by that piece of glass. All you could do was give me 100 rubles and send me into my cell. You couldn't forgive me that I had violated your laws. Here, I saved your life, that incident with the horse. All you could give me was 200 ruble. But you had to send me back into prison. You had to make that point. Because you couldn't forgive me. A true member of nobility can forgive. There's a saying, noblesse oblige. Nobility obliges. If you don't have the heart of a nobleman, you're not a nobleman. I knew you couldn't be a true Romanov. That's the story. I just want to take that story and put it in our day-to-day life. Each and every one of us has a tremendous innate nobility. We're created in the image of God. As Jews, we're privileged to have studied, to have the Torah, to have the means of cultivating that spirituality. We shouldn't forget we have this tremendous nobility. That's the source of our dignity. We should act the part. Noblesse oblige. Someone who is truly noble acts like a nobleman. And if we haven't acted like a nobleman till now, if we start acting the part, and we start giving respect, we start treating other people the way that we really desire to be treated, that innate nobility will come out. We may not be Romanovs, but I think coming from Avram Yitzchak the Yaakovs is coming from what we come from, we have nothing to be ashamed of. Thank you. Now, are there any questions? And are there microphones?
Oh, one moment.
Okay.
This particular lecture, Rabbi, is so broad in scope, it's very hard to summarize. Just about impossible. But I got a few thoughts. First of all, I know my own greatness, because you know, when I got married 35 years ago, my wife told me that I'm the most important man to her, and I'm hanging on to what she said. At this time, I'd like to wish you all a Shana Tova from my wife, myself, to your families. Should have a healthy new year, sweet and heartwarming. Good things should be happening to you throughout the next year.
Let's say you save a life, but the person doesn't know you saved the Lord. There's no reward in it. He did something for Israel. You are a patriot, and nobody knows. So, isn't the reward in the next world greater because you didn't receive the dignity?
I hope everyone understands the question. Let me just try to paraphrase the question here. We've discussed here about the idea of dignity. Very often we do good things in life. We get rewarded here in this world, at least by the respect that the people recognize that we're special people. But wouldn't it be better, perhaps, when we do it without others knowing? The mitzvah that we have is simply all the more greater. We didn't take any pleasure from doing the good thing here in this world. And perhaps we're saving like all the reward like for the next world. Is that right? There are, I believe there's two elements I'd like to respond here. One is, it's true that the things that the good that we do, just as we don't look for reward here, as we don't look for people's honors. We do it because it's right. And soifa kovod lovo, the end, the honors will come. And it's true that doing something which is positive is its own reward. In the fact that you've been lifted up spiritually, and as we pass from this world to the next world, it makes a whole difference in where we are spiritually. On that level, that's true. But there's another level. There's a passage in the Talmud, more in Shabbos, in Yom Beis, in 10b. It says, Hanoisin matona lechavera, a person who gives a gift to his friend, Sorach lohodia, should let him know about it. And we're not speaking about a charitable gift that the person will be embarrassed by taking, and therefore it's best to hide the identity of the donor. We mean just as a favor. You saved his life. And the reason the import, just you've given some, done some favor for a person. Because if you do a favor for someone, and the person realizes that, you've created a bond between two people. You've made life on this earth a lot more enjoyable. You've made it more enjoyable for the person who was saved. You made it more enjoyable for yourself. You've created a better world. When you do good for others in a way that the other person will not be embarrassed by being recipient of that good, you should tell the person. Not so much because you need the dignity, in other words, and I need the honors of that, but everyone needs goodwill. And it's important to cultivate that goodwill. So in a certain sense, when we do good to others, there is something to be said, you know, if it's a personal favor, to let the other person know.
It seems to me that humility, communicating is a very desirable characteristic. And it seems to me, there seems to be kind of difficult to be humble and believe yourself to be very important at the same time. How do you reconcile those two notions, or how do you separate them continue to understand the importance of both concepts?
Okay. Again, the question is how do we coincide a sense of humility with a sense of dignity? It would seem to be, at least on the surface, to be contradictory. There are two, again, as I said, to respond on two levels. And really what we're dealing with is on two levels of humility. In the most common definition of humility, a humble person looks at himself as no greater than anyone else. The fact is, what we have to be proud of ourselves is shared by every single human being. Besides that which is common, again, our intelligence, our free will, our sensitivity, our spirituality, each and every one of us has perhaps a special plus. One is a violinist, and one is a pianist, one is a poet, one is an artist, one is a psychologist, and one is a physician, the other is an attorney. Each one has their special talents. Everyone has their special pluses. But if I realize that, A, I am so important, and I have so much going for me, but yet at the same time, so does every other single human being, and I respect everybody for that, for what they have, I've not only given myself dignity, I've given others dignity, and I'm a very humble person. Because in my giving dignity, I haven't raised myself up. I've raised everybody else up, and in so doing, automatically I've raised myself up. So what we have is basically a level playing field. So that's one level of humility. There's another level of humility. And that really is a very, I don't know if we call it a subtle or spiritual sense of humility. And yet, for instance, I remember there was a time when I was growing up that it was thought that no person, no human being could run a mile less than 4 minutes. That was until Roger Bannister ran the 4-minute mile. After that, it was shaved 3 minutes and this and 3 minutes and that. Let's say I have just won the world record for running the mile. And I ran it in 3 minutes and 42.5 seconds. And then there's some hick who comes and runs it in 1 minute. Not only do they spoil all my fun, but I feel like I'm just a nobody, you know. You know, I mean, I had all this honor, and I'm a nobody. I mean, here's a guy who can run it in a minute. So we feel very humbled by, at least when we thought we really had something going for us, and then we realized it was really, in truth, very little. The subtle sense of humility is we are all created by God. And in the presence of God, we're truly nobodies. I mean, we're just nobodies. We're just, how great we are, but we're just a nobody. I mean, you know, we can have our resume that can read for 20 pages, but you know what I mean, but it doesn't compare to making, you know, Shemayim Voritz, you know, making heaven and earth. You know, it's, you know, the sense, our sense in standing in God's presence automatically creates a tremendous humility. So no matter what we accomplish in life, and no matter how much dignity we're truly worthy of, but we think of ourselves in terms of God, we're truly very humble. And in that sense, we say Moses was the most humble of all men, because he was the person who was closest to God. So that's the other level, the second level of humility. And if you think about it, you know, we have a lot to be proud of, but we have an awful lot to be very humble for. Okay, good night.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.